It's my honor, my pleasure, and my fortune to be with all of you today. Thank you, Mr. Kumar, and to all of you. I was requested to speak something about a book that I wrote entitled The Journey Home. Actually, I never wanted to write this book. Since about 1972-73, when I told some stories, people would say, "You should write a book about this." And I always replied, "I will never write a book about this." Because I was thinking it's an act of arrogance if I write a whole book about myself. Every page will be filled with words like I and me and mine. And second, I was thinking if I tell the truth, no one will believe it's true. But then something happened. One of my closest friends, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he was lying on his deathbed. He had melanoma cancer. He called me and said, "The doctors tell me I have 3 days to live. Please come and visit me." Now, I had a very busy schedule that summer, but I said, "I will come." And I was in the middle of this big festival with about 1,000 people, and I was giving lectures, and I just left it and went to him. And I was planning to stay on for one day. And when I came the next day to say goodbye to him, he said, "Please stay with me. I want to die in your arms." And I was under the impression he had 2 more days. So I said, "As long as you're living, I'm with you." But then he lasted 8 weeks. So I had to change my whole schedule. And I stayed with him, I promised. But I could say that in my life, I had read in scriptures about spiritual relationships between the soul and God and between souls and each other. But I never realized how deep it could actually be in an experienced way. Because we were under the impression that every day, it's almost for sure he's going to pass away. We never thought there would be another day. So when we spoke to each other, we made a vow that as long as we were together, we would only speak those subjects that would bring us closer to Krishna, who is our worshipable God. And we will not speak anything else. Only stories from the scriptures of God and his incarnation, stories from the scriptures about great saints, histories of saints, or our own experiences and realizations serving our guru and trying to help others. And for 8 weeks, for hours every day, we kept on that subject. And the love, beyond the body, beyond the mind, soul to soul, that we experienced with each other was absolutely incredible. When two or more people put seva, service to God, between them, then the relationship is eternal. It's ananda. It brings such joy from the heart. It was extraordinary. But one day, he said to me, "You should write a book about your travels when you were a young man." And I said, "I will never write this book." I was already well practiced for 35 years saying like that. And he said, "Your story is everyone's story. It's the story of a person who's looking for meaning, looking for fulfillment, looking for purpose in life. If your story could inspire anyone, then it's an act of arrogance for you not to write the book." And then he said, "Promise me on my deathbed you will write this book. And you will publish it." What could I say? He was laying there on his bed. I was sitting at his side. I said, "I promise." And then he grabbed my hand and squeezed it quite hard. And he said, "You cannot tell a lie to a man on his deathbed." So I left the room and I decided within a few days I'm going to convince him to let me withdraw that promise. But he left. Krishna took him before I could convince him. So in his honor I wrote this book, The Journey Home. I was a teenager in America in the 1960s, a time where there was much turbulence in the country that I was from. There was a war in Vietnam. There was issues of civil rights. And there seemed to just be so much complacency spiritually, that the younger generation, a large section of it, revolted against the establishment. Two of our very honored guests in the audience tonight are Padma Shama Devi, Sharon Gannon, Sridhar. They were around during those days. And many people like them, really, because they saw there was so much hypocrisy, so much shallowness, so little purpose, they became activists. So I also became an activist. But like them, I realized that this counterculture that was activated into activism, they had the same problems we were activating against. Just different dress and different language. And ultimately I came to the conclusion, like them, that unless we change ourselves, we can't really be an instrument to change the world in a deep and purposeful way. Just like if you have boils in your body due to blood disease, you could put salves and different compresses on the boil, which is good. We have to do that. But the solution is when we actually treat the blood, purify the blood. So my friend Gary, who I grew up with from 10 years old, when I was 19 years old, it was our summer break from college, he said, I'm going to Europe. You should come with me. I said, Gary, I don't have any money. He said, I don't either. But Frank, our mutual friend, is going to pay for us. So I was convinced. So we took a very cheap airlines to Iceland and then to Luxembourg. And the first night, Frank got robbed and left back for America. So Gary and I, we didn't have anything, but we had enthusiasm. We wanted to become instruments of change in this world. And we began to go to museums, studying art, studying music. We started going to forests, studying nature. And little by little, we were just hitchhiking. Wherever anybody was going that picked us up, we believed that's where God wants us to go. And as time was going, especially when I was in Italy, living in monasteries and cathedrals and synagogues and so many places, I came to the conclusion that what I really want is spiritual, a spiritual transformation. But there was a problem, because in my life I saw so much hatred, prejudice, and violence in the name of religion. People hated me because I was from a minority religion. I saw people who even were going to their religious places and who were very respected for religious people, who were not giving people rights because they were a different color skin. So either I had to give up religion altogether, or there had to be an essence of all these great religions that was something beautiful and transformative. And I believed in that essence. So I was looking for it. And I was studying various religions of the world. And ultimately, Gary and I were living on an island in Greece, Crete. And there I would climb a mountain alone and meditate from sunrise to sunset. And Gary would go down to the ocean side and do the same thing. At least that's what he said. One night, the sun was setting. It was a beautiful sunset. That whole day, I was praying, crying for direction. I really didn't know where to go. It was time for me to go back home and return to college. I hadn't found my spiritual path. I was praying to God, please guide me. And it wasn't just a formal prayer. It was with such the deepest sense of urgency I ever felt. There was a yearning that I'm lost without spiritual direction. I'm a hollow shell, no matter what I gain in this world. And I heard three words. It was a silent voice that spoke from within my heart, but it was the loudest voice I ever heard. Go to India. I had never met an Indian. I had never eaten a chili pepper. I didn't know where India was. I didn't have a map. And I didn't have money to buy a map. But but I believed it was God calling me to India. So I returned to the cave, and Gary was sitting there, and he said to me, "Something incredible happened to me at sunset." I said, "Tell me." He said, "You won't believe me." I said, "I will." He said, no, you won't believe me." I said, "Please, just tell me." He said, "I heard three words. Go to Israel." I said, "Where?" He said, "I told you you wouldn't believe me." I said, no, I didn't hear you. Where?" He said, "Israel. We should both go to Israel." I said, "Gary, he told me to go to India." "India?" So there was silence. And then I told Gary, "I'm leaving for India at sunrise." He tried to talk me out of it. But at sunrise the next day, I hitchhiked to the northern coast of Greece. Then I hitchhiked on a boat to Athens and started hitchhiking to India. Through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And from the beginning of the trip, it was 6 months when I reached the border of India. And I had gotten so many diseases, and I really was living a life that I couldn't even imagine. Every moment was a total culture shock for me, hitchhiking through the Middle East. And when I reached the border, they wouldn't let me in. They said, "You need $200 to come in our country. Show me how much money." I remember I had 26 cents in four different currencies. And they rejected me. I was stranded in this no man's land between Pakistan and India. I couldn't go back into Pakistan because I didn't have a visa, and I couldn't get into India. And I begged for 6 hours going back and forth to this desk. And finally, the border guard changed. It was a Sikh gentleman, a very elder man. He took the post. And I cried. And he rejected me. And I cried more. It wasn't fake tears. It was for real. I was desperate. I said, "Please, just give me a chance. I've risked my life and given up everything of the comforts of my home just to meet your people and to learn from your people. Just give me a chance. I promise, someday I'll try to do something good for your people." And he said, after looking at me for a long time, staring, he said, "Sometimes a man must follow his heart. My commanding officer ordered me to not let you in, but I'm going to give you the chance you're crying for. Welcome to India." And he stamped my passport. And that was such a blessing, because human nature is, if things come too easy, we don't understand or appreciate their value. We take it ordinary. But when you really have to struggle, have to cry, when there's challenges, and then you gain something, you really appreciate its value. I felt liberated. Eventually, I went to the Himalayas and roamed through the Himalayas. And I'd like to tell you just a couple little stories with some lessons from that journey. while wandering in the Himalayan forest near Devprayag, I met someone named Kailash Baba. No one in the world ever heard about him, except other sadhus who wandered in the Himalayas. Because when he was just about 12 years old, he left his home. Now he was in his 60s or 70s, but other sadhus said he was 150 years old. But I don't know. But he had lived in the jungles all his life. And I was just out of my teens, 19, I think I just turned 20. And he taught me how to live in the jungle. What foods to eat, what berries and roots and leaves, and what not to eat. He taught me which of these plants were medicinal. He taught me how to sleep, you know, in caves and under trees. And he taught me how to live with my neighbors. Because this is 1970, the Himalayan jungles, there were leopards, there were panthers, wild elephants, vipers, cobras, scorpions, wild boars. And he taught me, if you think that you are superior to them because you're a human, they will kill you because this is their land and you are helpless. Because I didn't have any weapons. And they did. And then he told me, and if you have the slightest fear of them, they will kill you. He said, you have to see that the living force within everyone is divine. The living force within everyone is a part of God, a child of God. Due to karmas, destiny, whatever it may be, we have different types of bodies with different types of intellectual capacities. But the Atma, the soul, is the same in everyone. It is sacred. If you honor them and honor God within them, then you will have no fear. And they will honor you. Now, this was a pretty crash course, as they say, because it's not like I had time to study it and memorize it, because, you know, they were around me right then when he was speaking. But I learned a few things. One is by the association of an enlightened person, a realized person, so much faith can give us the strength to actually overcome our weaknesses and our ignorance. Because Kailash Baba so much lived that principle, his whole life, I believed it. And in his company, I could see the cobras as my brothers and sisters. I couldn't tell which one, because I'm not one of those people. But they were my brothers, even the mosquitoes that were biting me. I could feel it. They're hungry, just like I'm hungry. And faith so much comes from the company, the satsang, of people with realization. Another thing I learned, that the transmission of knowledge is not just based on words. It's based on the eagerness to learn and the compassion to give. Because Kailash Baba did not know any English. And I didn't know Hindi. I don't even know what language he spoke, actually. But because he so deeply cared about me, and because I was so eager to learn, just by his pointing his fingers, his moving his eyebrows, I could understand what he was saying. And I learned more from him than I ever learned in all the schools I went to, elementary school, high school, college in America. Because real knowledge comes through grace. One of the most difficult things he taught me, more difficult than actually learning to live with the wild animals, was how to live among different sects of sadhus. What is the respect you should give each other? Because if you don't give each other the proper respect, it could be very, very difficult. But he was like a father to me. And he loved me like his own son. But he was a homeless wanderer, a hermit, and I knew I was taking too much of his time. And I knew that destiny was calling me, so I left him. I came to one place where I learned a similar lesson. I was walking alone through the Himalayan forest, and I came into a leprosy colony where all these people, this was at a time when nobody cared anything about the lepers. Society just pretended they did not exist. They were just laying in the cold ground of the Himalayas. They had rags. Some were naked. Some no fingers, no nose. And they surrounded me, about a dozen of them, demanding I give them bakshish, donation. But I didn't have anything. I was just a little sadhu roaming around. After about 20 minutes or a half hour, they finally searched me completely and let me go. And as I was walking away, I saw an old, dying leper woman. She had no nose. Her face was decomposed and it was deranged. She had no fingers, no toes. Hardly any hair. She was just laying, and she sat up, and she looked at me with the glance of a mother for a child. She looked at me in such a way that I felt that she felt the pain I was in when her people were harassing me. And she put her hand out to bless me, like this. And I felt such a love from her, and it was real. I ran over and put my head under her hand. I was bowing down to her. And in Hindi, she was saying, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you, my child." I looked up. And she was smiling. She only had a few teeth. And her eyes were glistening with tears. Her heart was yearning, possibly for long years, to bless a child. And I was giving her that chance to bless me. And I remember thinking something that will be difficult for you to understand. Because I was born and raised in America in the 50s and 60s. I used to go to the movies, Hollywood, and all of that. When I looked up at her, I have never seen anyone so beautiful as hers. Her physical form didn't change, but I could see her heart. She was just yearning to love and for someone to receive her love. And I remember thinking that we should not judge anything or anyone just according to the external situations. If we go deep, everyone, that's all they really want, is to love and be loved. That's the nature of our hearts. Anandamayobhyashat, later I learned from the Brahma Sutras, that every living being is seeking pleasure. The pleasure of the mind and the pleasure of the senses could give some little enjoyment. But it's very shallow, and it's soon to evaporate. The only pleasure that can touch the heart is to love, to give love and to receive love. And the origin of that tendency within all of us is the Atma, the eternal soul's natural love for God, for Krishna. And to experience the unlimited, infinite, sweet, beautiful love of Krishna for us. I went on with my journey. After some time traveling through the hills of the Himalayas, the mountains, and the plains of India, I happened to come to Mumbai. And here, I was taking a meditation course. And one day, I just decided to take a walk. And I saw a big hoarding billboard advertising a spiritual festival. So I went. And by evening, there was about 30,000 people. And I was sitting way in the back. And there was a stage. And people were singing and playing instruments. And then the guru came out. And he just looked so special, so humble, yet so divinely empowered. And something happened in my heart. But I could hardly see him. He was so far away. And I was thinking, I wish I could get closer. But I was very shy. And to get closer means you have to walk over people, hundreds and hundreds of people. So I just sat there. And then I saw the guru talk to somebody, and that person went to the stage and went like this, calling for someone, but no one came. And then that person came down and came all the way through all the crowds of thousands and thousands of people, tens and thousands of people, and came all the way to the back and walked up to me and said, "My guru, Prabhupada, wants you to sit next to him on stage." I asked, "How does he know me?" He didn't answer my question. He just pulled me. And in those days, I was very pullable. So he just pulled me, and I just was like a little dog, and he was just pulling me, like the leash of his arm, and he pulled me onto the stage, and he brought me right up to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada just welcomed me, because there was a big kirtan going on, so he didn't speak, but he welcomed me to sit beside him, and I did. And that's how I first met Prabhupada. And I stayed with him for about 14 days. But I was still searching, and I decided to go to the Himalayas after his program. And it wasn't until about nine months later or something that I'm running out of time, so I'll be really brief. I ended up in Vrindavan. I was on my way to Amarnath to go to see Lord Shiva because I was told he would fulfill all my desires. And I was praying for direction. What is my path? And my train got stranded, a third-class train, 300 people in a capacity of 60, and we finally was stranded in a field in a monsoon rain for 20 hours, and finally we got to a station, and I just jumped out the window looking for water, and the train left without me. Where am I? I asked a sadhu. He said, this is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. So I went to the Janmasthan. And in a few days, I went to Vrindavan, and then I was going to leave for Amarnath the next morning, but the next morning, I had typhoid fever. And I was almost dead, just laying on the riverbank alone. What a blessing. I would have left. It was through that challenge that I remained in Vrindavan and after some time decided I never want to leave this place. And I'm going to tell one more story. I was on a mountain in Barsana. Barsana is the home of Sri Radha, Krishna's divine spiritual potency, the embodiment of bhakti, of prem, of love. And on this mountain, it was very secluded in a forest. There was one sage, and he would sing kirtan on the roof of this ancient ruin. It was a temple from hundreds and hundreds of years that was crumbling. And the only people beside myself that were at that kirtan were the village children. Little children, skinny little children. They were dancing and they were singing. And after the kirtan was finished, one little boy, he was, I think, about 8 years old, he grabbed me by the hand and said, and just pulled me. And I just went with him. And he took me to a place on the rooftop of this old temple. And there was a little straw hut that he and his little friends built. And in the straw hut was a little altar made out of straw. And on it was a poster of Krishna. And he had a little calf in his arm. He was sitting on a rock holding a little calf. And the boy was still holding my hand. And he looked up at me. It was a very full moon that night. And I remember this little boy, he had very deep black eyes, and the moon was reflecting in his eyes, giving off so much light. And he smiled. And he pointed to the little poster of Krishna. And he said, this is my God. And then he let go of my hand and ran away to play with his friends. That experience transformed me. I was looking at the poster. I was thinking, that little child spoke with such conviction. I've met yogis and rishis and lamas and sages and babas and so many people, but such conviction. And it was with such simplicity, such innocence, such total trust. In his presence, I felt at best like an atheist. And I remember looking at the picture, praying, Krishna, someday give me the faith of that little child. And I remembered the words of Jesus from the Bible, where he said, unless you become like this child, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Simplicity means without duplicity. Simplicity from the heart. And all our philosophical analysis is meant to bring us to that place within our hearts, that simple love and faith. And that little boy became one of my gurus. And later on, I met Prabhupada again in Vrindavan. And that is where I just wanted to be an instrument to help him in his work of compassion in the world. Those are a few stories from the journey. Thank you very much.